Okay, we're now recording, so watch yourself. All right, first, two things. First of all, for those of you who are interested, courtesy of Sylvia Hoffman, I brought the Barcelona, not the Barcelona Haggadah, but a facsimile edition of the Barcelona Haggadah, which was printed, which was created and printed, we believe, based on tracking where it was first reported in the 14th century. So in fact, you're looking at a faithful reproduction of something that is, 700 some years old. And I just thought that I would pass it around. Please obviously handle it with care, but it's a facsimile, so it's fairly hardy. I thought it might be a nice thing to look at. Just take a look and pass it along. Because Haggadahs are one of the areas where Jewish artists were actually permitted to exercise their art. And that was also true in ancient synagogues, but that's another. And then I thought that I would start with, before we got to the text itself, with a nice little comment. Larry Kushner, who is a Reform rabbi and a teacher and wrote lots of nice works on mysticism and so on, wrote a little Torah commentary with David Mamet, the playwright and writer. Anyway, and each of them, for several passages in the Bible, each of them will make a quick comment. And this is Larry Kushner's comment on crossing the Red Sea. He says, "So Israelites follow Moses and his God only to wind up between the approaching Egyptian chariots and the abyss of the Red Sea. Now there is no turning back and no moving forward. It's logically impossible. Cannot be done. You can either be in the midst of the sea or you can be on dry ground, but you cannot at the same time be both. The Hasidic master Dov Ber of Mezrich teaches that there's a place, an order of being called Ayin, nothingness, through which anyone or anything must pass before it can become something new. Just a split second after it is no longer what it was, but before it is what it would become." Okay, you with me so far? There's this one tiny, for an instant, you're not what you were, but you're not yet what you're about to be. "This is a place of great terror. When you enter the nothingness, there can be no guarantees. All bets are off. You could become anything or remain nothing forever. Such a place contains both a thing and its opposite, sea and dry ground, life and death, good and evil, slavery and freedom. You want to know what happened at the sea? I'll tell you. The waters didn't literally split. The people all walked into the sea and drowned. Then they walked into the opposite shore, reborn into free men and women, into the Ayin." So I thought that was a beautiful comment and a wonderful idea. That we always think it has to be one or the other, but that there is this stage where everything is both, and then, right, you can stay in that stage and be nothing, or you move on and create yourself into something. Yes, the name of the book, for those of you who want it, it's called Five Cities of Refuge, and it's by Rabbi Lawrence Kushner and David Mamet. It came from Amazon yesterday, just in time for Passover. So, all I can say is Amazon is both the greatest blessing and the greatest curse of my reading life. Because Ruth Seymour, who is the head of KCRW, says that she has next to her bed the shelf of constant reproach. You know, the books that constantly say, you should be reading, how come you haven't read me? You said you were going to read me. And all I can say is Amazon has made my shelf into a library of constant reproach. Now, let's first go in our little Passover Bible exploration today to chapter 26 of Deuteronomy. Because this is the heart of the Haggadah, but we're not always aware of what it is in context. Okay? The entire Haggadah is based around one short biblical passage. And what we're going to do first this morning is look at that biblical passage in its context, and then we'll look back a little bit at the story of crossing the Red Sea. Once again, for those of you who will see this book, that is being passed around. It's a facsimile of the Barcelona Haggadah, which is a Haggadah that was published in the 14th century, so about 700 some years ago. Okay. And one of the things you can see there is that traditionally Jews did do art, as art of human beings as well as other things. Okay. Chapter 26 of Deuteronomy. Everybody have it? When you enter the land, I'll wait till you find it in your... If you found it in that... What page is it on? Can you just tell them?
1140.
If you have Eitz Chaim, it's on 1140, 1141, okay? Well, I don't think anybody else has this. But if you have this, it's on page 429. This, by the way, is the JPS Hebrew English Bible, the entire Bible, not just the five books, the Tanakh, okay? So, all right. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a heritage, and you possess it and settle in it, you shall take some of the first fruit of the soil, which you harvest from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God will choose to establish his name. In other words, you get into the land, you have your first fruits, remember all agricultural life, and you go to the temple and you bring your first fruits. You shall go to the priest in charge at that time and say to him, I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God that I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. The priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God, and then you shall recite as follows before the Lord your God. Now this is the passage that's in the Haggadah and is commented on in the Haggadah and makes the bulk of the service in the Haggadah is an elaboration of this passage. My father was a fugitive or a wandering Aramean. Who's that talking about, by the way? Good question. Jacob is one interpretation. The other is Lavan, because Lavan is specifically called the Aramean, but usually assumed to be Jacob, because of what follows. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there, but there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, and by awesome power, and by signs and portents. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Wherefore, I now bring the first fruits of the soil, which you, O Lord, have given me. That's it. The commentary on this, on each phrase of this, is what makes up the Haggadah, right? For example, when it says, the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us, that's when you sing Avadim Hayinu. With God's deliverance, that's when you sing Dayenu. All of those things are comments on this passage, and the Haggadah is a midrash. It is a rabbinic elaboration of the Bible that is supposed to tell you what it is that the Bible intends to teach. And this declaration, what are you doing, by the way, when you bring first fruits to the temple? What do we call that in modern terms?
Tithing.
Well, tithing is it's an ancient term, but in modern terms, when you do it in America, you do the same thing. What do you call it?
Taxes.
Paying taxes. That's right. That's what it is. It's paying taxes. Because, I mean, you also give a half shekel to the temple, but you're bringing your first fruit and you're not eating them. Who's eating them? The priests. It's a tax to the priests. Now imagine if when you pay taxes in America, you started off by saying, and my ancestors came on the Mayflower and they landed at Plymouth Rock. And I mean, that's what they're doing, basically. They're giving a capsule history of all of the Jewish people before they pay taxes because they want to emphasize how fortunate they are to be here. Which is exactly what, you know, which is exactly what people ought to feel actually when they pay their taxes. It put taxes in a very different light. You ought to be able to say, and I recognize all the sacrifices throughout the years that people have made in order to create this free land and so on, and therefore I give to the government of this land, which is what ensures that freedom and so on, the taxes that I pay. Very different attitude towards taxes than... So I wonder if in ancient Israel people put like rotten fruit at the bottom of the basket in hopes that the priest wouldn't notice until they went back home. I don't know. Okay. So, now that again, that's the whole declaration, and in capsule, that's the story of the Passover. So, now let's go back to the story itself, and look at chapter 12 of Exodus. I don't know. I can't. I'd have to see it. I don't know why. I don't know who wrote it, so I can't tell you. What's that? No, chapter 12 of Exodus. Okay? The Lord said to Moses, now, this is right before the last, well, I'll wait till you get there. Once again, if you found it in Eitz Chaim, what page is it on? 380, page 380. Okay? There have been 9 plagues. Pharaoh has said that he's going to let the people go and then doesn't let the people go. God hardens Pharaoh's heart, which is, by the way, there's a comment actually in here on that too, from David Mamet that I noticed just this morning. He says something about hardening Pharaoh's heart. Oh, yes. This is what David Mamet writes, who also, by the way, has a show on TV, The Unit. He writes very cryptic and clipped English, but he's a brilliant playwright. The Hebrew text states not that Pharaoh hardened himself to deny the Jews, but that he hardened himself to let us go, and that Hashem, in response, slew all his firstborn. At the risk of a homiletic, perhaps, a homiletic means, you know, a sermon, maybe Pharaoh's action was that of the self-congratulatory philanthropist, well-wisher, liberal, bleeding heart, pick your own epithet, who, having made a difficult, costly choice, pats himself on the back, regroups and recruits himself for the generally lengthy and frequently infinite period before its implementation. In other words, he decided, I'm going to do a good thing, and then he doesn't do it. Really, it's like, you know, we have a lot of outstanding pledges to the synagogue. So, just thought I'd mention it. So Pharaoh hardened himself to let the Jewish people go, and Hashem slew the firstborn. For the decision itself was nothing laudable. Pharaoh had decided to let them go before, and the resolution itself is nothing. Without action, it is a self-worshipping fantasy. Nice little comment. Again, the book is 5 Cities of Refuge. And Larry Kushner is the one who, I've told this story before, but since I'm quoting him and pushing his book, I'll tell it again. Larry Kushner and I were supposed to teach this class in New Jersey to the rabbis of that era of the New Jersey, New York area. They had asked us to do a session together. So it was months before the session, and we both agreed we'll do a session. And then about a month before, they called me and they said, so what title did you two agree on? And I hadn't spoken to him about it, so I quickly called Larry and I said, Larry, we got a problem because they want a title, and you and I haven't talked about what we're going to teach, and the truth is I have no idea what we're going to teach. And he said, I have a title that always works. He said, it doesn't matter what's going on, what the situation is, what the class is, this title always works. I said, really, what is it? He said, Judaism at the crossroads. I never forgot. I thought that was great. So if you ever get stuck, doesn't matter what the field is, at the crossroads. And Judaism is always at the crossroads. So, okay, chapter 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. Now, this is right before liberation, remember? This month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. Remember, Passover is also New Year's, right? There are 4 New Years in the Jewish tradition. Passover is one of them. And also, Passover is the first holiday because all the other holidays follow from it. Even Rosh Hashanah, the creation of the world, doesn't get celebrated until there's a Jewish people. And there's no Jewish people until there's Passover. So Sukkot, Shavuot, all of that becomes, and in fact, I read a nice comment. If you look at, I think it's in chapter 4 of Exodus. You don't have to look. I'll read you the verse. I think it's 4:22, but I'll tell you in a second. If I'm wrong, I won't search for it. And if I'm right, I'll just pat myself on the back. Yes, I'm right. That's okay. I won't pat myself on the back. It says, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. So the Meshech Chochmah, who was a fascinating character, anyway, said, and a really deep and interesting Jewish thinker, said, that doesn't mean that Israel is the best. He said, being first, especially firstborn, doesn't mean best, but there is something special about the firstborn, because it is the firstborn that establishes the parent as a parent. The firstborn defines the relationship. Israel made God a parent, as your firstborn child makes you a parent. And that's why it's important that Israel was the firstborn son. It's because that's what made God a parent, not because it makes Israel better than the secondborn or the thirdborn or the fourthborn. Because, as we know from the Bible, is Esau better than Jacob? Is Ishmael better than Isaac? No, but they're first, and that means that that's the one who makes Abraham a parent. So the fact that Passover is first establishes it in some ways as special, though it doesn't mean that it's the most important holiday, but it's what makes Israel a people. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. It'll be the first of the months of the year for you. Now, I'm going to ask you a question and see if you can figure out the answer to this. Rashi, the great medieval commentator, asked a famous question on the very first verse of the Bible. You know, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Rashi said, why didn't he begin with this for you is the beginning of the months? In other words, why does the Torah have all of that stuff up to here? Why didn't the Torah begin with chapter 12 of Exodus? Anybody have any idea why Rashi asked that? This is a tough one, not an easy one. Any guess? Take guesses, why not? Sure.
There's also the other Rosh Hashanah.
There is, but why shouldn't God begin the Bible with the creation of the world? Why should God begin the Bible? Why should God leave all of Genesis out, you know, all of the first quarter of Exodus out and start with the 12th chapter of Exodus? Why would that bother Rashi? And the answer is, you might think that it's because this is where the Jews become a people, but that's not his concern. This is where Jewish law starts in the Bible. Before this, there's almost no Jewish law. There are one or two scattered mitzvot, but now you're about to get the laws of Passover. So Rashi, being a medieval Jew, says, what do you need all the stories for? Why doesn't God just start with the law and tell us what to do? And by the way, his answer is as improbable to us as his question, right? We can think of lots of reasons why you would want the book of Genesis. But Rashi's answer, and imagine, I mean, this is somebody who lived actually about 100 or 150 years before that Haggadah that you're passing around, right? Rashi lived from 1035 to 1104, so the 11th century. And his answer is because God had to show that he created the world, so when he assigns Israel to the Jews, the nations have no argument against it. It's his right to assign it to the Jews, which is again, not an answer I think that most of us would come up with, but Rashi's concern was, in a world in which the Jews own no land, how can we prove that Israel is really ours? And the way we prove it is by pointing to the Bible. It shows that God created the world, and therefore God owns the world and can assign lands to whomever God wants. Anyway, so, yeah.
I get confused constantly in study. Before, during, up to this point, when the law begins, was oral Torah in effect? Was there such a thing as oral Torah going on?
Depends who you ask. I would say let me just say a quick word about this, because this is a subject of considerable scholarship, controversy, interest. It's a very interesting thing. For example, before the Israelites came to Sinai, what did they do? Did they keep kosher? Did they not keep kosher? Did they have any sense of Shabbat? Did they not have any sense of Shabbat? And for that matter, after they left Sinai or after the Torah was written, we all know that there are lots and lots and lots of laws that aren't in the Torah. Before Rabbi Akiva came along, did people do what Rabbi Akiva said? And the problem is that you can say when something starts, like that Barcelona Haggadah, we can say it couldn't be later than this because it's mentioned in like 1370. So we know by 1370 it existed, right? But maybe it existed in 1320. We don't know, because you can only say from the first mention that you know something exists, but how far back does it go? So how far back does Shabbat go? We don't know. The only thing we know is the first mention of it. So some scholars believe there was a long, rich oral tradition that always existed among the Jews, because after all, every community has its traditions, and they eventually got written down. Other scholars think that, in fact, traditions grew over time, and that the writing down actually contributed to the traditions itself. But let's say in 1,000 years, someone wanted to know what went on at Sinai Temple. Now, there are things that go on here all the time that people know about. For example, when the sermon happens, they close the doors. It's not written anywhere, right? So let's say in 1,000 years, there's still a Sinai Temple, and they still close the doors when the sermon happens. Someone will say, I wonder how long this has been going on. And someone else will say, well, look, it's been going on as long as I remember, so maybe it goes back 100 years, with no idea that it goes back 1,000 years, because how would you know? So it's very... The answer, all of this is by way of saying nobody knows, but they argue about it. Which the best arguments, of course, are those where there is no answer. That's why people always say you shouldn't argue about facts, even though we always do. Right? Speak to the whole community of Israel, I'm on verse 3, and say that on the 10th of this month, each of them shall take a lamb to a family, a lamb to a household. But if the household is too small for a lamb, let them share one with a neighbor who dwells nearby in proportion to the number of persons. You shall contribute for the lamb according to what each household will eat. Your lamb shall be without blemish. I'm just going to go through this fairly quickly. A yearling male, you may take it from sheep or from goats. Keep watch over it till the 14th day of this month. And all the assembled congregation of the Israelites shall slaughter it at twilight. They'll take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the house in which they are to eat it. They'll eat the flesh of it that same night. They'll eat it roasted over a fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Don't eat any of it raw or cooked in any way with water, but roast it, head, legs, and entrails over the fire. You shall not leave any of it until morning. If any of it is left until morning, you shall burn it. Now, the first thing I want to point out is, what's the only part of this that we really talk about with these days, is putting the blood on the doorposts, right? But you see that the first mention of Passover is about the sacrifice and the eating of a lamb. And it tells you again how central sacrifice food was to every tradition, but even starting with the Passover sacrifice. Now, this is how you shall eat it. And by the way, in some corners of the world, this is still observed, that people still do it this way. Your loins girded, sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it hurriedly. It's a Passover offering to the Lord. For that night, I will go through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn in the land of Egypt, man and beast. I will mete out punishments to all the gods of Egypt, I the Lord. And the blood on the houses where you are staying shall be a sign for you. When I see the blood, I will pass over you so that no plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Now here's another question. Why don't they know? I mean, why does God need a sign? Why doesn't God know which houses are the houses of the Jews? Yeah.
Maybe he wants there to be a pledge to wait for
okay.
To say, I participated.
One possibility is that God, I mean, this is a sort of modern possibility that this is the possibility that a modern rabbi would give a sermon on. Right? It's because God wants the people to make a declaration. It's not about God, it's about the people. But there is this feeling here, and the Midrash even picks up on it. The way the Midrash puts it, the rabbis put it, is when destruction is loosed on the world, it makes no distinction between the righteous and the wicked. And that's certainly true. I mean, the hurricane doesn't stop at the house of somebody who's a good person, right? But there is a sort of magical feeling here. Right, that destruction is going to come through, but when it comes upon the blood, it stops there. Almost like homeopathically. You know, the principle of homeopathy is that you take the thing that makes you sick, and if you take enough of the thing that makes you sick, it wards off the sickness. So if you put blood out there, it will stop blood from coming into the house. And that feeling exists even to this day. I mean, why do people kiss mezuzahs? They can give you all sorts of rational reasons, but there's also this kind of magical sense about it that it's warding off something bad. Okay, yeah.
Like a, I don't know if I'm wrong, like a covenant or a reminding of how they burned the pieces and the blood. And
it could very well be a covenant that calls to that, harkens back of the covenant with Abraham, the covenant between the pieces. The idea of sacrifice, I mean, this is a much longer discussion, but the idea of sacrifice is not only at the center of Passover, but it's at the center of Judaism, clearly. I mean, that's why the extension of it into the idea of Jesus as a sacrifice was still an extension of what is a Jewish idea. Because, you know, like the scapegoat and the sacrifice is vicarious. It's supposed to be, you know, I'm not on that altar because God accepts the sacrifice instead of me. And in fact, we know in the ancient world that human sacrifice was very common. And part of the point of the binding of Isaac, of the Akedah, was God doesn't do that. Even though Abraham doesn't seem so surprised by the request, God doesn't do that. Because Abraham, as you say, was used to sacrifice and the idea of sacrifice. So, yeah.
Who's God talking through here?
Through Moses, presumably, or Aaron, who's Moses' spokesperson. Yeah. But it doesn't say explicitly. Sometimes it says, you know, God said to Moses, you know, say to the people so-and-so. But God never speaks directly to the people until the Ten Commandments, and then only the first two, and they get scared. Yeah?
I've often wondered how many of the neighbors of the Israelites saw the painting of the blood and emulated it.
The question of how ancient people saw the Jews, and there are a couple, there are some books about this. Peter Schaeffer, who is a very great, a very fine scholar who's not Jewish, wrote a book about how ancient civilization saw the Jews. There is a big mixture. I mean, some Jewish customs got disseminated. Some of them, you know, some of them were thought of as ridiculous. But it depends which ones. You're talking about in the Egyptians, what the Egyptians thought?
The Jews putting up this blood on posts, and they said, why? And somebody says, well,
I think what they probably did was go swatches. Forget it. You know, they're just trying a little swatch of red to see if it goes on the doorpost. Yes. The Egyptians were a very decorative society.
Why a lamb?
I can't hear you, Don.
I say, why a lamb?
Oh.
It's very specific in the portions we're reading now. Talk about, you don't have a bull, you use the distance, you don't have that, you use the turtle dove.
Right.
This is very specific.
I'm not sure. I'm sure that there is. I'm sure there is literature on why a lamb, and I don't know if any of the commentaries that you have say. I don't know. I'd have to think about what it is that a lamb represents, other than obedience and docility, and yeah.
But doesn't the concept of the shepherd and the lamb, the shepherd taking care?
Yeah, that may be why. It may be right. That makes sense. It may be because of the shepherd idea. The flock idea, that you're God's flock. I mean, all those things are possible. And also because it's a sacrifice probably that the Egyptians would permit. Because remember, they are still in Egypt. And they don't want to say at the moment, you know, sacrifice those animals that the Egyptians think of as God. That comes later. I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah.
In response to that question, the early Israelites, the early Jews, but they adopted a lot of the customs of what was going on. Some
Yes.
So I would imagine it would not have been too much of, you know.
There's always a mixture. You know, the Romans did a lot of things that the Etruscans did, and the Greeks were combinations of Mycenaean and Minoan, and, you know, Americans were influenced by the Dutch and by the British and by, you know, everybody else. There's always, even the conquerors get influenced by the people they conquer. It just, you know, that's what it is to live in a neighborhood of people who have different customs. So, okay? All right. So, this day shall be to you one of remembrance. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord throughout the ages. You shall celebrate it as an institution for all time. Now, I mean, this is in some ways very moving. This was written thousands of years ago. And in human history, thousands of years is all time. You know, and we're still doing it. We're about to do it next week. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. On the very first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Yeah.
So just going back to the lamb, I just found something here. The next step towards liberation, it's at the bottom of 380 onto 381.
Okay.
Was to slaughter a lamb publicly, something no Egyptian would do, and mark the doorpost with its blood. In this way, they would proclaim their psychological liberation from fear of Egyptian opinion and from an eagerness to imitate Egyptian customs, a necessary prerequisite to physical liberation. The sages see the lamb as a symbol of idol worship, and its public slaughter as a reputation.
So there's the exact opposite of what I said. That's fine. which is that the Egyptians wouldn't slaughter a lamb, and therefore they slaughtered a lamb to proclaim their liberation because lambs were... I didn't know that lambs were symbols of idol worship. I heard bulls, but I didn't know lambs. I believe it. I'm sure that it's right. But what's that?
It's the Paschal lamb.
The lamb for Passover. Yeah. Have I heard of jeans?
Yes, they're
symbol of
idol worship.
I don't...
Denim.
I don't get it. Am I the only one?
Talk to her later. But,
yeah, right. Wool, it's wool, it's not denim. They're not made from lamb. Are they? I know. Well, what can I tell you? The other thing that you'll notice here is, of course, how many days is Passover?
Eight.
What does it say here?
Seven.
So why does it end up being eight? What's that? Yeah, in the diaspora, right, where you don't know exactly when it starts. When it ends, we add a day to make sure that you don't mess it up. That's true. And also, the punishment of Kareth, of being cut off from Israel, is what? We talked about this once before. It's not clear whether, there is a theological interpretation, there's a sociological interpretation. The theological interpretation is that you get cut off in some way from God. The sociological is that you get cut off from the community so that people don't associate with you in the community. And then, just as we do today, you shall celebrate a sacred occasion on the first day and on the seventh day. That's Yom Tov. No work shall be done on them. Only what every person is to eat, that alone may be prepared for you. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this day I brought your ranks out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day throughout the ages as an institution for all time. In the first month, from the 14th day at evening, you'll eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. No leaven shall be found. Here's the verse that gives you so much trouble. No leaven shall be found in your houses for 7 days. For whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the community of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a citizen in the country. You shall eat nothing leavened, but in all your settlements you shall eat unleavened bread. Why so important, unleavened bread? What's the symbolism here? What does it matter? Oh, come on. You all clean out your houses and you never ask yourselves why unleavened bread?
Because they were in a hurry.
Yeah, that's the usual explanation, but so what? So they were in a hurry. Okay, as a reminder, so you appreciate your freedom. I think all those things are true. What? Anyone know what leaven represents? Right. Well, Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is leaven. In particular, ego, because bread, what's the difference between bread and matzah? Bread is puffed up. Right, bread is puffed up. So bread thinks well of itself. Matzah is humble. But also I think that the idea is that nothing that you, in normal life, there is nothing that touches you as much as what you have to eat several times a day. And in fact, on Passover, you never forget that it's Passover. You can't. Yeah.
In a way, it's just your own personal sacrifice on a daily.
Yeah, I guess it is. Your own personal sacrifice on a daily basis. Right, you're not supposed to eat matzah the rest of the year. This is a problem with our model seders, but the kids are kids. It's when they say the parents should share it that they actually make a mistake because the parents aren't supposed to have matzah, especially not right before Passover. Right. You don't eat matzah the rest of the year, and the idea is that it's supposed to be special only to Passover. Although matzah ashir, although usually people say that it's only for a month or two beforehand, and matzah ashira, which is enriched matzah, like egg matzah, onion matzah, things like that, people eat during the year. During the year? Matzah is okay during the year. You're just not supposed to eat it well in advance of Passover. Also, as it turns out, most people don't end up eating matzah during the year. You know, I at the end of Passover, I always say, you know, it's not so bad. I really should have matzah sometime during the year. And then I never, ever, ever do. So
egg matzah and onion matzah are not okay during Passover?
It depends. You have to look on the box. Egg matzah, strictly speaking, is what's called enriched ashira matzah. And it's supposed to be given only to people who need it. That is, if for whatever reason, what's that? I'm sorry? Because matzah is really supposed to be flour and water, you know, that doesn't rise. But some people will use it, you know, if you look on the side of the box, it will say sometimes kosher for Passover, and then it'll have all this Hebrew writing that says for people who are, you know, of delicate constitution or things like that. So you have to check the box or ask somebody to check the box, and it'll tell you whether it's supposed to be. There's a category in Jewish law called an istinis. And an istinis is somebody who, for example, is allowed to wash on Yom Kippur or to eat matzah ashira because they're delicate of constitution. So so you have to decide if your constitution is delicate. Yeah.
I have a question about the... Is it ever contemplated in the conservative movement that since the reasons for the 8th day don't exist
anymore? Oh, yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah, I know. All right, don't get my wife started on this, please. You're not doing me. If you thought the joke was bad for family harmony, just wait till we start talking about the 8th day. Let me put it generally. Some people really don't like second day Yontif, okay? And I will tell you in fact, in the conservative movement, there is a tshuva, a responsum, that those synagogues that wish to drop the second day can, for exactly that reason, and some, only a couple have, one or two conservative synagogues that I know of have. And let me tell you why the ones that have not, have not. First of all, let me tell you the famous moment in the rabbinical assembly, and this really is, I mean, famous in as much as, you know, conservative rabbis know about it. My father told me about years and years ago when they were having this debate about whether to drop the second day or not, and a rabbi got up and actually ended the debate by saying, you may not drop the second day because you need one day for your family and one day for hers. And that was, everybody cracked up and they said, okay, well, that's it. But I mean, growing up, I asked my father many times, what do you need second day Yom Tov for? And his answer was always the same, which makes sense. He said, there is a population, and there certainly is here too, that observes second day Yom Tov. Those who don't observe it, don't observe it. To take it away from people who observe it doesn't accomplish anything, and all it does is take away one more observance from people who care about it and observe it, and very rare are the people who don't care about it but observe it anyway. So that was his reasoning, and that's basically what people have done. Because really, the category is very small of people who, even though they don't care about it and they think we shouldn't have it, end up observing it. So basically...
But in Israel, it's
only one day, right. But that's always been true. It's always been one day in Israel and 2 days in the diaspora. No, that's everybody. The tradition of not having rice is based, well, I shouldn't say no. Yet the answer is yes and no. That's where the misunderstanding originates that prohibited rice. I gave a sermon about this a couple of years ago, and I explained it in detail. But basically, Ashkenazim thought that legumes were used for flour in baking and could rise. And they were just wrong, because they didn't eat those. So they outlawed them, and now it's been outlawed for hundreds of years. I mean, we eat legumes in our house. We eat rice. I encourage other people to do it, too. In particular, if you're vegetarian, it makes sense. But there really is the only reason, I don't want to say that this is a trivial reason, but the only reason not to have legumes and rice is what's called minhag avotenu biyadenu. The custom of our fathers is in our hands. In other words, once you've been practicing something for a long time, there's a reluctance to give it up, even if the reason for it isn't a good reason. So for many Ashkenazim, it's equivalent to eating a piece of bread. Yeah.
Aren't there two Yom Tov at the end of the week also?
Yes. For the same reason, which is you don't know what the exact, outside of Israel, you don't know what the exact time was, so they added an extra day.
So then, technically speaking, if you were going to, let's say, drop a day.
Right. Yes.
Okay, so you not only drop a day.
At the beginning and at the end. Right.
At the beginning, yes. You would not have a second day, Yom Tov, you would
right.
have a second Seder.
Right.
And at the end, you wouldn't have a second day.
Right. And Simchas Torah and Yizkor would be on the same day as they are in Israel. Yep. You have Yizkor and Simchas Torah the same day because that's the way it is. And Shavuot is one day, and you know, and there you have it. But let me just say, I think that it would be, I'm not sure what doing that here would accomplish. I'm not sure. Although I must say, second day Yom Tov, if you come to the synagogue, unless it happens to be on a Saturday, we have services in the chapel for 150 people. 100 people. But still, 100, 150 people, even though it's small at Sinai Temple, you know, that's a considerable population that show up. On some Yom Tovim, we get fewer. We get 40, 30, 40. Service is very quick. You know, we're done by 11. Yeah.
Isn't the explanation that we do it two nights because we are in Galut?
Yes. Yes. That's the reason. The Reform movement also has dropped the second night for many years. And in the Reform synagogues, there's only one day of Yom Tov. All right. I think they did. I think. But not for a long time. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if when the movement first started in Germany, they did 2 days, but I think so. Yeah.
I'm going back to something you said earlier. I'm wondering if eating the matzah just for that period of time, because it's so special and we are reminded to have this festival, it's like we're in covenant. It's a constant reminder that Passover is something special and to be treated with thought of the Chavanah.
Well, any ritual is what's called an ot, a sign for something special, right? So matzot are too.
But you made this one because of intimacy of eating, which takes right. about touching and mezuzah yeah. things like that. Very intimate, very touching.
True. Ingestion is right. Okay. All right. I want to actually skip, so we just get to do verse 29. In the middle of the night, b'chatzi halayla, really at the half of the night, we would call it midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night with all his courtiers and all the Egyptians because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there was not someone dead. He summoned up Moses and Aaron in the middle of the night and said, "Up, depart from among my people, you and the Israelites with you. Go, worship the Lord as you said. Take also your flocks and your herds as you said and be gone. And may you bring a blessing upon me also." Now, the reason that I think this passage is so powerful, and by the way, look at the next verse which adds to it. The Egyptians urged the people on, impatient to have them leave the country, for they said, "We shall all be dead." Is two things. One, this is actually, in some ways, even more than the Red Sea, this is the climax of the story. Because it does two things. One is the horrors have mounted so much that Pharaoh finally, really wants them to go. Even though he changes his mind after they go. It took all of this. And his request for a blessing is his acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God. And that's what it was supposed to accomplish. Because after all, God created the universe. It's not so hard to beat Pharaoh. I mean, if you think about it, it's absurd to think, look at the mighty power of God. He can defeat the king of Egypt. What's the king of Egypt? But to change Pharaoh's outlook, that's difficult, right? That took a great deal of work. And also to change the outlook of the Egyptians, to have them actually give up on having the Israelites as slaves. And then, okay, so, let's go. They consecrate the firstborn. They continue with the Passover. And by the way, the consecrating of the firstborn, remember that those of you who have firstborn males in your family, Wednesday morning at 7:30, have them come to Minyan for the study, followed by the breaking of the fast of the firstborn in their last bagel. Okay. Let's go now to 14, just so we get the story before we go. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp before Pi Hachirot, between Migdol and the sea, before Baal Tzephon, and you shall encamp facing it by the sea. Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, 'They're astray in the land, the wilderness has closed in on them.' Then I will stiffen Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, that I may gain glory through Pharaoh and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord," and they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his courtiers had a change of heart about the people and said, "What's this we've done, releasing Israel from our service?" He ordered his chariot and took his men with him. He took 600 of his picked chariots and the rest of the chariots of Egypt with the officers and all of them. The Lord stiffened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he gave chase to the Israelites. As the Israelites were departing defiantly, the Egyptians gave chase to them, and all the chariot horses of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his warriors overtook them and camped by the sea near Pi Hachirot before Baal Tzephon. As Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them. Greatly frightened, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. This is the first time that this happens, right? Though they're going to do it a lot of times. And they said to Moses, "Was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt? Isn't this the very thing we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us be, and we'll serve the Egyptians, for it's better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness.'" So now we know what the Israelites were saying to Moses back there. As he was trying to liberate them, they said, "Forget it. We don't want this. Let us serve the Egyptians rather than die in the wilderness." Because you can imagine, the idea of walking through a desert must have terrified them. I mean, they all had families. They all had little kids. Imagine if you had to wander through a desert, and they didn't know 40 years. Had they known 40 years, they really would never have left. But you have to wander through a desert. They said, "Look, we basically made our peace with this. We're okay. We don't like it, but we're okay." It's just like there was an article about women in Afghanistan, and it talked about the horrible conditions that they live under, the fact that they have no freedom. The incidents of domestic violence are off the charts. I mean, you know, it's rare that you find a home where a woman's never been hit, and yet when you ask them, they say, "We're fine, we don't want to change." And that same idea here is, there's such a powerful need for human beings not to change the situation that they're in because they've made their equilibrium with it. Somehow they're getting along. So as long as they're getting along, to change is much more difficult even than to continue to suffer. And the same thing was true here with the Egyptians. That's why, according to one tradition, God didn't liberate the Israelites until they cried out to him, because it wasn't until they were fed up with their own slavery that they had a possibility of being liberated. Yeah?
Nothing. I just set it up. Fear of unknown.
Yeah, fear of unknown. Okay. And then the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward." Now, I want to stop at this sentence, because this sentence also tells you the difference between where Jews were and where they are. In Hebrew, God says to Moses, "Ma titzak, why do you cry out a lie to me?" Okay? Rashi, the clear sense of this sentence is, don't cry out to me, tell them to walk, right? I mean, what do you want me to do? They got to walk forward. Rashi, though, not liking the idea that God won't take responsibility for this and puts it on the people, because remember, Rashi lived at a time when people had very little power, the Jewish people had very little power, and everything was on God, says that what God is really saying is there should be a comma after Eli. Ma titzak, why are you crying? Eli, it's on me. In other words, I'll take care of it, right? Which is how Rashi turns this around, and if you ask yourself, why does he turn it around that way, the answer is because he couldn't conceive of God saying that people have the power to liberate themselves, right? I mean, that's a commonplace for us, but for Rashi in the Middle Ages, couldn't possibly be. How can people liberate themselves? I mean, look at the world. The only force that can liberate us is God. So he completely reverses the meaning of this verse, which is an amazing thing. and lift up your rod and hold it out of your arm and over the sea and split it so the Israelites may march in the sea and dry ground, and I will stiffen the hearts of the Egyptians. They'll go in after them and gain glory through Pharaoh and all his warriors, his chariots and his horsemen. Let the Egyptians know that I'm the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. The angel of the Lord who had been going ahead of the Israelite army moved and followed behind them. The pillar of cloud shifted in front of them and took up a place behind them, and it came between the army of the Egyptians and the army of Israel. Thus there was a cloud with the darkness, and it cast a spell on the night so that no one could not come near the other all through the night. So all night long the Egyptians couldn't come to the Israelite camp. Then Moses held out his arm over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry ground. The waters were split, and the Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. The Egyptians came in pursuit after them into the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen. At the morning watch, the Lord took down the Egyptian army from a pillar of cloud, looked down upon the Egyptian army from a pillar of fire and cloud, and threw them into a panic. He locked the wheels of their chariots so they moved forward with difficulty, and the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." They were about to go back, and the Lord said, "Hold out your arm over the sea, and the waters may come back on the Egyptians, on their chariots, and on their horsemen." Moses held his arm over the sea, and at daybreak, the sea returned to its normal state, and the Egyptians fled at its approach. But the Lord hurled the Egyptians into the sea. We don't tell it that way, right? We say the sea closed on them, but that's not how the Bible tells it. God made sure all through this that the Egyptians will be drowned in the sea. The waters turned back and covered the chariots and the horsemen, Pharaoh's entire army that followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the Israelites had marched through the sea on dry ground, the waters forming the wall for them on the left and the right. Thus the Lord delivered Israel that day from the Egyptians. Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. And when Israel saw the wondrous power which the Lord had wielded against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord. They had faith in the Lord and his servant Moses. So what does it remind you of that they see the Egyptians dead on the side of the sea? Reminds me of Abraham after Sodom and Amorah. Remember watching the smoke rise from the kiln, like from the smoke from a kiln. So, yeah.
Why did it take 40 years?
It took 40 years because God needed the generation to die off because they weren't ready for freedom. That was after the sin of the spies. He said, "I can't bring this generation into the land. They have to continue to wander till I bring up a new generation who are born in freedom, who know how to be free." In fact, Rabbi Shmuel Moliver says that the reason that the sea had to close back was not to kill the Egyptians, but because that was the only way to prevent the Israelites from going back into Egypt. Which is a, you know, and the truth is there's, you know, not for that specifically, but there's support for that idea. They clearly are not a generation ready to be free. Which is exactly, by the way, the question, it's exactly the question with things like Iraq. Which is, when people have never had any training in freedom, how long does it take? And can, in fact, a generation be turned around, or does it have to be the next generation? And the only counterexample that I know of, but here it has a lot to do with the British occupation, is Israel. Because the people who were the leaders of Israel were people who came from slave states. I mean, they came from Eastern Europe. Ben-Gurion never knew a free state, you know, and yet they were able to create freedom. But a lot of that, I'm sure, had to do, first of all, with the revolutionary ideologies in Eastern Europe, and also with the British occupation in Israel, and also with the fact that they were extraordinary people. I mean, they just were. I mean, Chaim Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, you know, if I don't want to exaggerate it, but I think if Iraq had a Chaim Weizmann and a Ben-Gurion, they'd be much better off. And there's, although Sistani seems like an exceptional human being. But all right, and with that, I'm going to close, and please return the Haggadah. Yes.